طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. In a newly published book, Israeli historian Adam Raz shatters the conspiracy of silence that surrounds the widespread Jewish looting of Palestinian property that took place in 1948 during the Nakba. Drawing from materials he found in more than 30 archives, Raz documents how in the period around the 1948 war, Jewish civilians, who after the war became the founding generation of the State of Israel, pillaged private Palestinian property throughout the land. Raz also documents how, as the looting took place in full public view, Jewish leaders, including David Ben-Gurion, knew what was happening and, even as some expressed disapproval, did nothing to stop it. Raz's research sheds light not only on this phenomenon of widespread theft by Israelis' founding generation, but also on the political impact that this looting had on Israel's relations with Palestinians and the fate of Palestinian refugees. As Raz observes, having robbed their neighbors, Israeli civilians became accomplices to the political situation, with a vested interest in preventing their former neighbors from ever returning. To discuss this research and what it means for both Israelis and Palestinians, as well as the process of using archival materials and retelling history to achieve a more just future, we present this week a Foundation for Middle East Peace webinar featuring Adam Raz, researcher at Akhavot Institute for Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Research, and author of Looting of Arab Property in the War of Independence, and Yusuf Munayer, non-resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., in conversation with Sarah Ann Minkin, Foundation for Middle East Peace, Director of Programs and Partnerships.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, welcome. I am Sarah Ann Minkin, the Director of Programs and Partnerships at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. The Foundation for Middle East Peace works to promote a just resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We work to advance this goal through our grants program, through ongoing research and publications, and through public programs like this one. You can learn more about our work and subscribe to our many resources and our webinars at our website, fmep.org. I am very happy to welcome you today to our webinar entitled A Founding Generation of Looters, New Research on Israeli Theft of Palestinian Property in 1948. By way of quick background, in a newly published book discussed in recent Blockbuster Haaretz article, in a recent Blockbuster Haaretz article that my colleague Kristen McCarthy is going to post in the chat window, Israeli historian Adam Raz shatters what he calls the conspiracy of silence that surrounds the widespread Jewish looting of Palestinian property that took place in 1948. Adam draws from materials he found in more than 30 archives and documents how the period around the 1948 war, Jewish civilians pillaged private Palestinian property throughout the land. Adam also documents how, as the looting took place in full public view, Jewish leaders, including David Ben-Gurion, knew what was happening. Some expressed disapproval, and they did nothing to stop it. His research sheds light not only on this phenomenon of widespread theft by Israel's founding generation, but also on the political impact this looting had on Israel's relations with Palestinians and on the fate of Palestinian refugees. Adam observes that having robbed their neighbors, Israeli civilians became what he calls accomplices to the political situation, with a vested interest in preventing their former neighbors from ever returning. To discuss this research and what it means for both Israelis and Palestinians, we are joined today by historian Adam Raz and by Dr. Yusuf Munayer. A little more background on both of our panelists. Their full bios are available on our website. First, Adam Raz is an historian, an Israeli historian whose field of research is political history of the 20th century. He is a researcher at Akevot, Institute for Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Research, and his newest book, Looting of Arab Property in the War of Independence, was co-published by Akevot and Carmel Publishing House and came out last month, September 2020. Yusuf Munayer is a non-resident fellow at Arab Center Washington, D.C. He writes on the Arab-Israeli conflict and is a member of the editorial committee of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Dr. Munayer holds a PhD in international relations and comparative politics from the University of Maryland. Welcome both of you to this webinar. Thank you for being here. Let's begin. Adam, I want to start with you to set the scene. So will you please tell us about your research process? To write this book, you drew from more than 30 archives throughout Israel. What are the documents you found that formed the basis of the book? Was it difficult to attain this material? Were you surprised by what you found?
Hi, Sarah, and thank you. And well, I tried to put in a single book, in a single volume, the most important documents, information about the pillaging of the Arab property by Jews during the war from 47 until the early 49. So I collect documents from something like 30 archives in Israel, and it was because of the scope of the research. It's not the story of one city or one village, because I try to tell the story of all the looting during the war from Tiberia in early April until it was the first city, the mixed city, Jewish and Arab living Tveria together. So from Tveria to Beersheba, the last city that was conquered in October 48, and to tell also the story of the something like 550 village, Palestinian village that was looted, and also the story of the churches and the mosque and so on. So it was quite a unique tour to do in quite a lot of archives in Israel. So it took me, I think, something like a year and a half to collect all the thousands of documents. And it was the first time that I don't use only the big archive, the formal archives in Israel, like the IDF, the Israel Defense Force archives, or the state archives. But I also go to a small and unknown archives, like archives of kibbutzim or a political party and political movement in Israel. And in those places, I find the most, I think, important and unique documents that tell the story that went behind the scenes. So I was quite surprised with the vast amount of files that I collected in to the 30 archives and so on.
What surprised you was the amount that you found?
Yeah, first of all, the amount. Well, you know, to do when there is the normal difficulty of doing research in, and it doesn't matter what's the topic of the research. Like you can't go to an archives and say, please give me all the material about all the file about how the Jews looted the Arab property. You need to go to different files and to use all sort of documents. So first of all, I was quite amazed by the amount of material that was untouched until today. So this was the first thing. And the second thing is that it was quite amazed to see that there was a lot of material about it. Like, I went to a few kibbutzim. I hope that the audience know what is kibbutz, but it's sort of a village in Israel. So I went to a archives in kibbutzim, and in those archives, I found letters and protocol about the looting that Israeli Jews tell about the process of looting, about the dilemma, about what happened. Let's take, for example, Beersheba, a big Palestinian city in Israel, and there were some kibbutzim in the area. So and Beersheba was looted, pillaged by the kibbutzim in near Beersheba, and when they brought home to the kibbutzim the stolen property, they talk about it. They wrote poem and letters about it. So it was, this is what really, really amazed me.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you. Yusuf, there has been a fair amount of research on Jewish looting of Palestinian property in around the 1948 war. A lot of work on Palestinian homes and especially Palestinian land, on wealth in the form of frozen and confiscated bank accounts, on libraries, books, and photographs, which were placed in Israeli archives in the Israeli National Library. What do you see that is new in Adam's research?
Yeah, I thank you guys for this conversation, doing this event and having me. I think I have not had a chance to see Adam's book yet. I've read about it and seen what he said about it and so on. I think, you know, any time that one can bring forward new material on the Nakba, on the events of 1947 through 1949, that's an important contribution. And I think what seems to me to be, the unique part about this contribution in particular is the focus on the phenomenon and the scale and scope of the phenomenon, which to my knowledge have not been documented in this way previously. So I think that is really important. Having myself had experience in trying to do historical research in Israeli archives, including military archives, I've really come to appreciate the difficulty of trying to navigate those spaces, which is, of course, far, far more difficult for Palestinians than it is for Israeli Jews. Also, the archives are becoming, a number of them are becoming increasingly restricted when it comes to materials about this period, and not just this period, but in recent years, there's been an escalation in the restrictions on material from this period. Files that were once open suddenly become closed and so on. So anytime we can shed light, I think, on that material, that's important. At the same time, I will say one of my initial reactions to sort of seeing the news about this is, as Palestinians and as, a Palestinian citizen of Israel in particular, the story of the looting of property, not just the confiscation of land and ethnic cleansing, but of the looting of property has been central within, the Palestinian historical narrative and prominent. And so I think, it's interesting the way that the way that Adam sought to document it all and to capture it as a widespread and singular phenomenon in the period, but also sort of, the way in which it's characterized as sort of a shock to the conscience, as if this was a surprise. And I think this is where maybe the biggest disconnect is between, people who are experiencing this from the different ends of it, is that, for us, this has always been part of the reality. And so I think, confronting sort of the Israeli conversation with this in a very direct way is important.
Adam, I want to ask you to tell us in more detail. Yusuf started talking about the scope of what you found, the breadth of what you found. So can you tell us more specifically, what is the looting that you talk about, that you write about? Who perpetrated it, against whom, and where? And also, you call it, in your research, you call it a singular event. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, my book has two parts. The first part of the book is about is the story of the looting, and actually is 250 pages, and it's quite boring, actually, because I'm just telling the story of the looting of each city day by day and each village and so on. So if I need to summarize, my finding is that many parts of the Israeli public, civilian and soldier alike, were involved in massive looting of the property of the Arab population. Now, the pillaging spread like a wildfire among the Jewish public, and what actually it's involved the contents of, I don't know, like tens of thousands of homes, of stores and factories, of equipment, mechanical equipment, of farm produce, of cattle, and more and more. And also it included all the material, all the equipment, all the furniture in the home of those Palestinian residents, like piano, like books, like jewelry, like furniture, like electric cars, and so on. So there is a debate about the amount, but we are talking about the material life of something like 600,000-700,000 Palestinians who share this land with their Jewish neighbor. So we are talking about most of the property, the property of the Palestinian neighbor. I'm not talking in my book. I'm not writing about the land. On the land issue is it's a different topic, a different subject. But I'm trying to tell the story how the Jews looted most of the property that the Palestinian neighbor have. So we are talking actually on most of the property. Okay, an account, a report that the custodian of the abandoned property, his name was Dov Shafrir, wrote in August 50. And he wrote, and this is the official report by the custodian, and he wrote that the issue of property, and I'm quoting from the report, it's in Hebrew, but it's translated, one of the largest and most complicated affairs in the War of Independence. And he also writes that this affair, the looting, was a difficult and complicated one, and it lasted a long time. The vast majority of the homes were founded by the inspector of his office to be burglarized, and the furniture in them ransacked. It is important to note that no clothes, houseware, jewelry, or bedding, aside from some mattress and such, arrived at the storerooms. So we actually talking about a singular event that took place in a very short time, actually. A few months, 3-4 months, that in this period, most of the property of the Palestinians who live in Israel was looted. So this is actually the first part of my book, the story of the looting.
So, Yusuf, what do you make of this framing, that the neighbor-to-neighbor phenomenon going through houses and ransacking them makes the looting by civilians together with soldiers, not only the army, and that this work makes the looting, as Adam says, makes the Jewish population in Israel directly invested in a policy of preventing the return of their Palestinian neighbors. What do you make of this framing?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what to make of it. I think it's a big conclusion to draw from the looting itself. In terms of historical perspective, I don't think that, I think looting is something that has happened plenty of times throughout throughout situations of war and colonization and so on. So in this sense, it's not unique. And I also think that, I mean, it's interesting to kind of look at this from the perspective of the everyday citizen's responsibility and investment in the ethnic cleansing and depopulation and maintaining that over time. But I also think we should be careful not to underestimate the role of the state and the state to be and the military in creating the kind of conditions that legitimize that behavior, which I think is really important. When we talk about the looting as theft and so on, what we're really talking about is the complete disregard of a people and their ownership and possession over property. And that sentiment is one that was really created, I think, prior to the looting, and some of the very brazen acts of, warfare and ethnic cleansing against civilian targets and infrastructure that preceded a lot of these the civilian ruling, the conditions, the atmosphere that was set. I think by the Haganah at the time, the Israeli military was one of wanton disregard for Palestinian property. And I would go even further as to say that, this is deeper than 1948. And we can see that same sort of wanton disregard for Palestinian property in the behaviors and policies during the British Mandate's repression of the Great Revolt in the late 1930s, when you had the ransacking of Palestinian homes carried out by squads in the British military, that in many cases, paramilitary Israeli forces, participated in. So I think there is a long and deep legacy that was being built up prior to this moment of disregard for Palestinian civilian property that created the conditions that really gave a green light to the population. So, that's sort of my thoughts on that.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yusuf, I want to stay with you for a moment and focus a little bit more on the role of leadership. Specifically. So Adam, in his book, he describes Ben-Gurion and other Zionist leadership as condemning the looters, the private looters. And the book cites many instances of Zionist leadership criticizing the looting and saying things like calling the civilians mobs, comparing them to locusts who devoured everything they could. David Ben-Gurion, there's this intense quote, "Most of the Jews are thieves." And many other leaders talking about their shame and this feelings of disgrace at seeing the levels of looting of neighborhoods and villages and homes and cities. A conflict here. Can you talk about or not how you see the relationship between the condemnation of private looting on the one hand and the formal legalized systemic seizure of Palestinian property through the absentee property law, on the other hand, and the absentee property law, as we know, is still used today to dispossess Palestinians of their property?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think this really relates to the point that I was making in the previous one, is that we can't disentangle the role of the state and state policy in creating these conditions and enabling this outcome. You cannot loot the property of vacant homes unless they are vacated. How did that happen, right? How is it that the people that are living in those homes were denied repatriation? Who's responsible for that, right? So the conditions on the ground that enabled all of this to take place were created and then enforced by state policy, by the policy of the Israeli government, and ultimately by Ben-Gurion himself. It's to me very clear hypocrisy to call out this behavior when every step that they took at the time created the conditions for this behavior to take place. I think, and I'm sure we'll get into this later on. And Adam's work is specifically on the personal property of Palestinians and not on the land. But when you look at sort of the big picture and over time, the biggest act of what I would call looting and really land theft and land laundering is the process that takes place from 1948 through the 1950s, through this legalistic process of first preventing the return of people, first militarily and then by law through the Infiltrators Law in the mid-1950s, and then using their absence as a claim to seize custody of their property. Prior to 1948 and the war, the Jewish population in Palestine, as individuals and as a collective of also, local and internationally run Jewish organizations, came to acquire through purchase something like 8% of the land of Palestine, of the land. And it was through this process of, land laundering, by denying repatriation and then using their absence to claim custodianship and then repurposing it almost entirely for primarily Jewish purposes. That is the single greatest act of looting that took place, the single greatest act of theft that took place. So, I think this is an atmosphere that was completely and totally licensed by the state, regardless to what words may have been reserved for individual actions here and there by the leadership.
Thank you, Yusuf. So thank you for all of that and for bringing in the state and what it looks like to specifically look at the leadership and the systematizing of this looting. And so, Adam, I want to ask you to speak more specifically about the role and the importance, in your view, of this new research on civilian plundering and its relationship to policy towards Palestinian residents who became refugees or internally displaced people. You wrote that, and I'm quoting, "The plundering was a means to realize the policy of emptying the country of its Arab residents, and that Ben-Gurion saw the looting as a tool to achieve his purposes." So can you say more about what you mean here?
Yes, thank you. Well, first of all, I read in some newspaper in Israel, in Arabic newspaper in Jordan and Egypt, that something like a few articles that thank you for Adam Raz for his book, but the main issue is not the carpet and the books and the piano, but the main issue is the land, okay? Because the Zionists or the Israelis stole our land, and it's part of the topic, but my argument in the book is that this is not purely an account of looting. But there is also a political story, because the pillaging was tolerated by the leaders, in the political and also in the military arena, and as you say, by Ben-Gurion, despite his condemnation in official forms, and the looting play a political role in shaping the character of the Israeli society, and it was allowed to proceed and fest with no interference. And this fact, and this is a political fact, that nobody stopped the looting, that me, the historian, need to give an explanation. Now, my argument is that the plundering was a means to realize the policy of emptying the country of its Arab resident. Now, there is two aspects for this. Well, in the simple sense of the matter, the looting turned the looters, the Jewish, who break to the neighbor house. It's turned the looters into a criminal. So this is quite easy to understand. But second, and this is most important, it's turned the looters who perpetrated individual acts willingly into accomplish to the political situation. Okay, it's turned the looter, the Jewish looters, to a passive partners in a political policy approach that strove to avoid the land of its Arab resident, and with a vested interest in not allowing them to return. Now, my argument is that the individual, the person who looted his neighbor property, and it can be a book, and it can be masabacha, it can be a piano, he was not aware of the process in which he was an accomplice to a political line that aimed to prevent the Arabs' return. Now, I don't think we need to discuss it here, but I have a different approach from Yusuf, I think, to the connection between the two communities who share the land until 48. I think that the Jewish and Arab who share this land, their connection was, I don't know what the correct word to use, but I think there was it's not a sad story. It's not a story of how the Jewish stole and manipulated the Arab, okay? But if we talk earlier about Haifa, or before the conversation started, well, in Haifa, we can see that I will tell the listener that Haifa was one of the biggest cities. It was a mixed city. 140,000 people live in Haifa, half, 70,000 Jewish and 70,000 Arab. And it wasn't a separated community, okay, who fought one another. It was a mixed community. And I think this is why I think the looting as a special, it's a special phenomena, because the Jewish who looted is, he wasn't looted an abstract Arab. He looted his Arabic neighbor. Now, this is why this is why my argument is that the person who looted was not aware of the process in which he was accomplished to a political line. But the specific moment that you, the Jew, enter your neighbor's building and remove the property. And again, it can be a masabacha and it can be a book. But when you remove the property of the Arab family that has been living there until the day before, and you know the family, and you know the people you stole the book from him, in this specific moment, you do something to yourself. And you have, and this is the important sentence, you have less motivation for them to return in another month or in another year. Okay? This is the place that there is what I'm call a passive partnership between a specific political approach and the individual looter. Okay? I think it's reinforced the political idea that expose segregation between the people in the years after the war. But this is the important important aspect that thousands of individual who looted, this all thousands of micro crime, when you look at it from a macro perspective, you can see a line. And my argument, and we talk a little bit more about it earlier, that it's changed the motivation of the Jewish resident in places like Haifa, because when the Palestinian who live in Haifa deported and fled the city in April 48, thousands of Jews told them not to stay. This is your home. We live here together. This is a mixed city. But after the looting occurred, something has changed. Because when you break to your neighbor's store or house, you do something to yourself. You don't know what you do. First of all, you do it's a crime, but it's not only a crime in the simple sense of the word, but it's become part of a political line or political policy. And this is my part of my argument.
Thank you, Adam. I want to ask you a follow-up question, specifically because you speak about the looters as passive accomplices to this policy. So can you tell us a little bit more about to what extent the state's actions, particularly the army, enabled this looting? What was specifically the role of the state? What did they do to regulate the looting or to profit from the looting?
Well, maybe I can quote you a few sentences from one of the documents I collected. This is from a report on Tveria, okay? And maybe it will give you the atmosphere of the formal or the informal approach of the state. Units of the Haganah, and we will say that Tveria, this is Haganah because after the establishment of the State of Israel, until the establishment of the State of Israel, we talk about the Haganah, and after it we speak about the IDF, or the Israeli Defense Force. So, but it's the same. So units of the Haganah come in cars and boats and loaded all kinds of objects. The Jewish crowd in Tiberia burst in. It's left a very harsh impression. The ugliness of it, our struggle is harm its moral level. So in most of the cases, in places, not in most of the places, but in Haifa or in Tiberia, for example, the civilians look at what happened after the city or the village was conquered or captured, and they saw that the army loaded on boats and trucks the furniture and the books and the jewelry. So this is what gave them the motivation to continue. Nobody stopped the looting, okay? But as you can see, the report is against the looting, but it's really hard to imagine the situation. But in city like Tveria, in Ramle Lod, in Akra, in Jaffa, the Palestinian resident disappeared. Okay, disappeared, expelled or fled in matters of hours. So the army took in the first hours, loaded all what he can find in the stores and in the house, and then the civilian who live in the street, who live in the same street, like in Haifa or in Jaffa, okay, just broke to the houses of their neighbors, or just broke the glasses of the store. So in most cases, and as you can see in what I read to you from Dov Shafri's report, the custodian, in most cases there was a sort of communication, I will say, when the resident, the civilian, saw the army or the Haganah or the IDF do the same. So it was sort of joint adventure, I would say. So this is why after a few months of war, most of the property was stolen, because nobody stopped it.
Thank you, Adam. Yusuf, I want to come back to you. You talked about the centrality of the narrative of looting for Palestinians. And compared the difference in Jewish Israelis confronting this story, I think you use the term shock to the conscience as a part of how Adam is telling this story, versus how Palestinians have been talking about the looting and the experiences of looting. And So I want to ask you about the impact of looting on families, on Palestinians as a community. And specifically, I want to ask you what you think compensation and reparations for looted property can and should look like.
Yeah, I think to start off, I just want to note that I think Palestinians had different Nakba experiences, depending on where you're from. Not all of them were identical, and they had different relationships with the pre-existing Jewish community, depending on where they lived. Haifa is one situation. It's very different than, let's say, villages in the Galilee that were either entirely Jewish or entirely Arab. And the relations between those communities might look very different. And the experiences that Palestinians had during the Nakba and the ethnic cleansing were different in those spaces as well. Why is this important? It's important because, you know, for I think the vast majority of Palestinians who were exiled during the Nakba in 1948, they left, in a short period of time, as Adam mentioned, either forced out or in fear of what was to come as the Israeli military was approaching, left their homes in haste, unable to really take very much with them. For the vast majority of Palestinians, that was the last time they ever saw their home and property. They can only imagine what happened to the property after that. Now, there was a certain subsection of Palestinians who experienced the Nakba that were not externally displaced, but internally displaced. And that is part of the Palestinian community that I come from. During 1948, my grandparents on both sides, along with many others, were internally displaced. What that means is they were forced from their homes, but they did not leave the country. They became refugees within their own country. In the case of my grandparents, refugees within their own city. What this means is they were actually able to go back to their property and see the condition that it was in, see who was living there, see what happened to their belongings and so on. And so there is a very clear sort of understanding of what took place because that experience was different in that way. And so one of the questions that I sort of have for Adam, and I hope maybe he can address this a little bit after I conclude, is, you know, there's a lot of history that's been written about 1948. And there's a lot of it that has been produced through archival material and Israeli military archives, much of it very important to shed light on. But oftentimes there is the danger of, trying to describe the situation entirely from that archival perspective. And there is a lot that is missing and can be missing. And now from the Palestinian side, the narratives are not necessarily captured in archives for a variety of reasons, but there's a tremendous amount of oral history that exists. And I wonder to what extent did you seek out Palestinians to hear about their own personal experiences, particularly the internally displaced ones who had the opportunity to actually see what happened to the property. I know, in my own case, countless stories about what happened to people's property, people who were able to get back to their homes and found everything missing from every cabinet and even, you know, the porcelain tiles ripped off the bathroom walls. People who, in the haste of and fear of leaving, buried some valuables in the backyard only to one day come back and find them having been dug up and stolen. The stories like this are, endless. And as I started in the beginning explaining, quite obvious to the Palestinians who experienced it. And so I think that, I would really like to know did you turn to Palestinians to hear about their experiences in your effort at documenting this phenomenon, because I think there is a wealth of information there that surely would not be captured in Israeli archives.
Well, yeah, thank you, Yosef. Well, this is raised a question of from the field of history. Well, first of all, I didn't use interview from today, from Palestinian Relief today, and I didn't use the interview from Jewish Israeli who live today. But I use, I think, hundreds of letters that a Palestinian resident from 48 wrote in 48 and 49 about the looting. And this is, I think, one of the most important document I use in the book, because we have very, very, very little documents from 48. Most of the materials are books, memorial book that Palestinian wrote in exile years after the war. But so I use hundreds of letters. And quite a lot of reports that the leftish party or movement in Israel took from Palestinian during the war. For example, I have quite a lot of letters from people who fled from Ramleh and Lod, from all the places in Israel, because I use this material in the book. So I think it gave me more accurate perspective than today, than to talking to a Palestinian who lived 72 years ago in Israel. But I think, it's, you need to read the book for it, but I think I try to give those absent Palestinian to give them a voice. And it was really, really important for me. Like, you know, for me, I'm wearing the clock of my grandfather. And it's really important for me, this clock. And I'm trying to, and this is the story of my family, this clock. And this is the heritage of my family. And if somebody will tell me today that there is another clock in Poland, my family is from Poland in a place called Sokowola, that there is another clock, hand clock in Sokowola, I will take the first flight to Sokowola and to bring the clock back. So I try in my book to give those small property, to give them a name. And this is why I'm using most of the book, I'm using, when it's come to the Palestinian, I'm using the name of the Palestinian that the property was stolen. But there is more work to be done on this subject, and especially I think from, I'm a Jewish and I'm an Israeli, and I want that my people, the Jewish, okay, will hear the story of the Palestinian property, okay, and of the Palestinian Nakba, and this is true as you mentioned earlier. I think that for a Jewish. Okay, for a Jewish Israeli to hear the story I mentioned in the book is like a bombshell. Okay, and to Palestinian to hear the story, it's a different thing. It's not a revelation for the Palestinian, because your family come from Lod and you know the story of Lod, okay? And the Palestinian who live in Haifa, the family that now are in Jordan or I don't know where, okay? They know that they left the property behind, okay? As my family and I know the story of the property that my family left in Poland, okay? Or another family left in Egypt. So, I try to give in my book to bring this piano, this carpet, this jewelry into life with these letters of Palestinian and so on.
Thank you, Adam. We're going to come back to this, to the question of who your audience is and what you're trying to tell them, which is thank you for bringing all of that in. But I want to stay specifically with the property for a moment, with the, yeah, with the piano and the watch and the, what did you learn about what actually happened to the property, where it ended up, and what do you think could have been done or could be done today with this property?
Wow. It's a hard question. Well, first, there is two questions. The second question is what can be done? Well, in my book, the book showed that there were decision makers were critical of what was happening in real time. Okay, it wasn't that all it was that all the leadership was adapted to the Ben-Gurion policy. Actually, most of them, and I think this is most of them, thought that the fact that Ben-Gurion had permitted the looting was intent to create a particular political and social reality. And this was the tool, the looting in Ben-Gurion hands, to achieve its purpose. So there was a different approach. And people like the Ministry of Minority Affairs, Bechor Shalom Shitrit, and other ministers were very critical of the plundering by individual and by the army. And in their view, one authority effective with concrete power in their end should have been created to aggregate, to collect all the property and to see to its distribution and handling. But in reality, Ben-Gurion objected to this idea and sabotaged it. So this is for the second question. Now, most of the property, and this is, I think, one of the things that happened after the article in Haaretz was published, that I got quite a lot of call from Jewish in Israel. And this is, I think this is a unique moment because people wrote the article, not the book, because the bookstore in Israel are closed. something happened because of this, because I got a phone call that people say, okay, unfortunately we have a painting in our houses, and I got a few calls from kibbutzim that we have a table and we have some carpet and think like that. So I think this is a moment that something can be done. This is not justice, okay? It's not justice. But after 72 years, I think most of the property, is long gone, but the jewelry and the art and the painting are somewhere in kibbutzim, in houses all over Israel. Because we're talking of some, we have this, I think, picture in our head. I don't know who, but I think most of the Jewish in Israel, they have this picture in their head that the Palestinian was a poor. All of them live in a village and they riding on a camel. This is not true. Okay, part of them live in a village, but in places like Lod or Jerusalem or Jaffa, when you look at the picture of the houses of the Palestinian, they live in a palace. Okay, the wealth is huge. So until today, you can come to, if you have a good eye for it, you can see the footsteps of this furniture, of this art, all over Israel.
You have been listening to a recording of a webinar sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, featuring the research of Israeli historian Adam Raz concerning the looting of Palestinian property during and following the Nakba. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
إلى بلد مهجر من مخيمي.